Hi, this is Daniel Garber, the movies for CulturalMining.com and CIUT 89.5 FM. Melody Maker was a UK weekly tabloid established in 1926 as a jazz paper for professional musicians. But by the 1960s, it shifted its focus, eventually becoming known as the Bible of rock and roll. Bands were formed in the classified ads at the back, and in the front, on the cover, a cover photo could launch a music career. But who were the Melody Makers who made it all happen? Melody Makers Should Have Been There is a new documentary about the legendary paper, its writers, photographers, and editors, and the musicians they wrote about. Using new interviews and period footage, it traces the rise and fall of an oral history of that era and that paper. The film is illustrated by the black and white pictures of Barry Wetzel, their chief photographer from 1965 to 1975, chronicling the gods of rock and roll. The film was directed and produced by award-winning Leslie Ann Coles, who is the founder of Toronto's Female Eye Film Festival. Documentary opens tonight in Toronto at the Royal Cinema, and I'm very lucky, very pleased to have right here in the studio photographer Barry Wetzel and director Leslie Ann Coles to tell us more about these Melody Makers. Hi, Leslie.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. Hi, Barry.
Hi, thank you for inviting us.
Thank you both so much for coming in. So, how did you start at Melody Makers? How'd you end up being a photographer there?
I was working in an old photo studio, very classic thing. They were doing food shots and static stuff. And I used to borrow their little Leica camera at weekends and go off to little jazz clubs and in the streets taking my own pictures, thinking I was Cartier-Bresson, son of whatever. Anyway, so I was working after that for a photographer who was a photojournalist, and he had passes to the BBC theatres and that. And he said, well, when you're not printing my pictures, why don't you go along and do your own stuff? And I did, and I was at Top of the Pops one day, BBC TV in 65, I think it was, or 4. And there was Dinah Ross Supreme sitting there being interviewed by a journalist from the Melody Maker, and I just sat down with them and said, is it okay, Miss Ross, to take a few snaps? And she said, yes, of course. And I took a few snaps, a bit gingerly, and the journalist next to me, Laurie Henshaw from the Melody Maker, said, hey, old boy, why don't you drop in one or two snaps to the Melody Maker? We can always use a picture. So I did, and it appeared on the front page the next week. And
That was it.
I got a credit, and they offered me a gig as a freelance photographer to work with the paper.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how it started. Pure accident.
But this radio, so I can't show you the photo, but that's an amazing shot of Diana
Ross.
If I
hold it up to the microphone, you can probably see.
if you concentrate hard enough in your mind, you might be able to. And how did you first hear about Melody Maker? What brought you to make this movie?
Well, I met Barry in 1996. We had a studio in the same building on Queen West.
In Toronto.
And I was in production with my first film, which was a 40-minute drama, and I needed a photographer to take some stills. And someone in the building said, oh, there's this photographer, you know, who has a studio here. And I actually hadn't really met Barry at that point. Well, I think I had met him, but I wasn't aware of his legacy and his iconic rock photo archive. So Barry and I became fast friends. He took photos for the film. And then he would often regale us with stories from behind these pictures. And I just kind of knew that at some point I was going to turn the camera on him and interview him, because he was such a great, charismatic, and a humble subject with some great stories. So that's kind of how
it
started.
Well, let's hear some of these stories, because I mean, I could spend the next 10 minutes just listing the names of these icons, these incredibly famous. I mean, Jimi Hendrix, David Bowie. Yes, every single group from this, you know, the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, Mick Jagger. So what was tell us about meeting a musician before they were famous, who became very, very famous.
Well, I guess back in 1964, 5-ish, only the Beatles were suddenly, gods. And fortunately, they started to sell units with their first album, and they've been turned down by every other record company, and the record companies were now wondering who they should sign. And there was these bands coming, like the Rolling Stones and the Kinks and whatever, hundreds of bands, and suddenly they all got signed because the record companies didn't know. We missed the Beatles, so let's sign everybody and hope they...
Is the British invasion?
So there was a sort of great... everybody got an album, I guess, and nobody was really famous. I mean, Jimi Hendrix came over here in 66, I think, or in England, sorry, and he started playing around little clubs, and it sort of went from that. Hey, have you seen this crazy guy, man? You know, and... the Melody Maker went to interview all of these people. So, you know, it was great to go and see Jimmy in his flat and chat about this and that. Because we were taken more as musicians. You could chat. It was a trust and honesty, and we can talk about anything. We didn't put down a lot of things and tell a lot of stories behind the scenes, because that was, you wouldn't like that done yourself. It wasn't paparazzi. We were trusted, and we trusted them. And there was a great freedom to... Hey, Pete Townsend, would you mind standing by the window? I want to take this. The light's just really great. Okay, man, you know. There was a great camaraderie and an honesty, and it was simple. I never thought I was doing anything important. I was just taking pictures and trying to make a good picture of whomever it was. And
But the pictures are, in many cases, what makes the stars. It's the one image people have. They hear the music, but it's the look. So can you talk about how you... capture the look of these musicians?
I was just photographing people basically as they were, based on photojournalism, because there wasn't anybody to follow in rock and roll. Al Wertheimer, who did the Elvis pictures, his early Elvis pictures, William Caxton, who did some Chet Baker, Art Caney stuff, but there was nobody doing music photography. So I had to learn that as I went along. But doing straight portraits was like, I know that. It's Rembrandt lighting, available lighting if you can. Keep it simple. And, hey, just stand there. And, hey, Sid Barrett is going to just be there, and you have to get whatever that is. It was pure chance and luck. But as you were saying about nobody had seen these people before, that was the opportunity the Melody Maker offered, because all the other papers were using stock pictures or pictures that weren't relevant. We went along to the actual gig, whether it was a live or an interview, and the journalist would do the writing. In the next week, there'd be the story with the pictures to go with it. So you could see in Tanganyika or wherever you were watching the Melody Maker, oh, there's Jimi Hendrix. That's what he looks like. Or that's Robert Plant. Or that's what happens on stage. And, you know, as Ian Anderson said in the documentary, well...
From Jethro Tull.
We couldn't see what we looked like on stage, but the pictures showed us what we were like, and we learned from that how to perform, how to hold the flute, and how to appear in the audience, because we were feedback, or I guess the pictures were the feedback for the artist to see what was going on.
I think Ian Anderson, I remember him saying, you'd see yourself on the front cover of Melody Maker magazine, and that became you. And I really felt that from a lot of the musicians, that you know... I remember Richard Williams, one of the journalists, said that Barry had his own style. I mean, he's an amazing photographer, and he brought that to Melody Maker, and that look, that style of photography actually became the Melody Maker just by virtue of the photos, because it was really the first time they were putting, you know, like Barry said, not stock pics, but like 8x10 or 8x11 photos in publications.
How did you... photograph. I mean, so they're at a concert on the stage. Where were you?
In the early days, I was probably one of the only photographers there, because nobody had cameras. You didn't see people going around to gigs with cameras in the early days. So I was learning. The thing you have to learn is the name of the doorman to get in, the roadies, and these are the important people, because they get you into places. And, you know, eventually I was pushed on stage by Peter Grant saying, "Here, take pictures." It was like, you had no choice. But that, we became, I guess, like as Joni Mitchell said, part of that star-making machinery behind the popular song, though I didn't realize that. And then Steve Hackett from Genesis told me last year in England, he said, wow, I mean... the picture, because we had a picture of Genesis on the front page, you know, the management could charge more money. Nobody'd seen us before, but it sort of launched our career. And I go, oh, I never thought of that. Oh, really? Okay. Well, it was, you know, somebody had to do it.
And then when you're actually at the concert, were you allowed to walk in front of the musicians on the stage, or did you do it from behind the curtain or in the audience? Like,
no, you don't interrupt what's going on stage, you know, if you can. But I mean, the front of stage is usually the best, or to the side of the stage. Occasionally you could walk around, but I knew all the roadies and all the characters in the band. It was like, sometimes you could get a bit closer, but I remember a festival, I think, in Lincolnshire. I think I was a bit pissed at the time, you know, that Rod Stewart was about 2 foot away in front of the faces because the pit from where we were taking was enclosed. We couldn't get back any further. And I'm standing up and he's looking into the camera. I'm going, it's like, how close can you get, you know? They were aware of that, and a lot of people did play up to that because it was like they knew they were going to get pictures, you know, in the paper, or they trusted me that it was going to be a good picture. I tried to put people in their best light and to carry out what they were doing so the audience got it, but the people reading the paper, they could see the picture, read the story, and they were there. You didn't have to be there. You got the atmosphere. I guess it was a Facebook of the day, basically. It came out a week later, you know. We were the cutting edge of that, though we didn't realize it, and then we had the opportunity to go out and discover bands like, hey, you've got to come and see this character. He's crazy. Joe Cocker waving his hands up and down. we went to a lot of first gigs, and people got on the front page or in the paper. They didn't have a record contract, but because we liked them, the editor trusted the fact that somehow we were picking the winners, but we never knew what was going to win because everybody was different. There was nobody like anybody else, so everybody had their little part to play. It was very diverse and a lot of fun, you know.
So the 60s turned to the 70s, and there's a definite change. Hair gets big, audiences, these arena shows go bigger and bigger, budgets are bloated, publicity becomes enormous. Can you talk about the shift from the 60s to the 70s in the sorts of musicians and the look of Melody Maker?
Well, from what I learned, when I was in London, I went to the British Library and I went into the archives, and they had quite a collection of Melody Maker magazines. A lot of people were under the pretense that Melody Maker actually ceased to exist by the late 70s, actually carried on until 2000. And they were clearly trying to reinvent the magazine. And a lot of the people I interviewed, you know, basically spoke to the punk movement, and there was a different attitude. You know, you spoke to the fame and the money and the big stadium concerts, and people were making a lot of money. And Barry can certainly speak to that as well. But I think the access changed by the mid-70s, sort of the mid-70s into the late 70s. It became more challenging for the journalists and the photographers. And the punks had a certain attitude. It was like, you know, F you. You know, they hated the establishment. And so there was certainly a changing of the tide in that period, most certainly. And you could see it when I was looking at the archive. It shrunk. They went to a small little glossy paper. They kept reinventing the masthead. You know, they kind of alienated their core audience, which were fans of rock and roll. And so I think that's kind of led to the change.
So both the rise and the downfall.
Yeah.
What do you think, Barry?
All of that is true. I think for the...
What was it like for a photographer when it suddenly became so big?
Well, you see things getting bigger. I mean, I saw the Rolling Stones play to 30 people in 1964, I think, in a little cellar, and it was like fun. Then it gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and then you've got the Yes with Rick Wakeman eating curry and drinking beer on stage, and these huge lights and all this. Things are getting bigger and sillier and more distant, and also that... So it was a sort of invisible wall. Some of the journalists were upsetting the artists by writing stuff they didn't agree with, but you couldn't just say glowy things about everything. And
I mean, there's critics and there's journalists. There are two separate things.
Well, it did. Yeah, it sort of affected me peripherally, but I wasn't because I remember in Paris we went to see a Led Zeppelin gig, I think, and unfortunately Chris Welch had written a review of the Led Zeppelin album. I can't remember which album it was. It was a bit less than glowing. And we were met in the Georgetown Hotel by Fat Fern Patsy, the bouncers Led Zeppelin, who were the most scary people. They said, "I think you should come to the bar. Peter's not happy with you. You need a drink." So we did. Peter turns up later. "You've been naughty boys." And he shows us a review. And I went, "What? That's Chris Welch. Nothing to do. We don't know anything about that." I said, "You better make a good one this time, you know." But anyway, we went off great. We had a great time, but I flew off to New York after that. And of course, the pictures didn't get in the paper. So they had to use an old picture from another gig. And a couple of weeks later, I'm walking around a dark area of London, Penge, which was like, this. Jaguar pulls up and window rolls down. "You've been a naughty boy." I go, "Oh no!" It's in the middle of nowhere. It's Peter Grant, fortunately driven by his wife. And he's, I said, Peter, no, I'm happy. "Well, don't do it again, right?" It gives me a wink, rolls the window up, and buggers off. You know, so you have to be careful. But we didn't realise that a lot of the artists were that sensitive to stuff. I mean, I was walking down Water Street one day after we'd been to Led Zeppelin did a gig in Belfast and Dublin, dangerous places.
During the Troubles.
Yeah, it went down great. We went front page and all of that. A couple of weeks later, I'm walking down Lower Water Street, run into Jimmy Page, who's going, here, Wentzel, clutching a whole load of Aleister Crowley stuff. I said, "Oh, hi, Jimmy, what's up?" "Here, what's this?" And he shows me the back of the Millennium Maker, which was the mailbag. People would write in, only a little paragraph, and somebody had taken it, didn't like the gig or something. He said, "You were there, it was great, wasn't it?" I said, "Yeah, but that's only one person, Jimmy." And, you know, I mean, see the editor, but you've got to accept a bit of criticism. I mean, you run the world, but I mean, you're worried about some little chap in Birmingham who didn't like it. "Oh, that's so sweet, but it's nothing to do with me." and by the way, why are you? "Oh, I just bought Aleister Crowley's house and nobody wants to come and stay there." I went, "Oh, God." You know, the beginning of the end of egos and fame and who knows what, but you could see things dissolving. The record company's getting bigger, the budget's excess, people falling off the edge. And I decided in 75 I'd had enough and left the party and went off and did, like Monty Python, something completely different. You know?
Well, to see the full story, you've got to see the movie. It's called Melody Makers, and it opens today in Toronto with a Q&A at the Royal Cinema. I've been speaking with Barry Wentzel and director Leslie Ann Coles about this new fantastic documentary. Thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Keep on rocking in the free world out there, as one great Canadian said. Right.
This is Daniel Garber, the movies each Friday morning on CIUT 89.5 FM and on my website, culturalmining.com.